Just a small correction to make. I was talking about Angulimala, the psychopath. Martin kindly corrected me. It's not teeth, it was fingers that he was collecting. So he was making himself a garland of fingers just to add to the drama. Teeth fall out, but fingers don't generally drop off, so. But the lesson is the same, that there's a price to pay for every action and every thought and every deed and word.
And I believe the word Angulimala actually means the garland of fingers.
Garland of fingers, that's right, Martin was telling me, yeah. Mala being the garland and Ang being the fingers. So garland of fingers.
And also, I believe he was going to, his next victim was going to be his mother, and Buddha saw it in his heart. Buddha saw it, and that's how.
It was going to be his mother.
Yeah.
But didn't he have to kill 100 people, wasn't that? Or
Yeah, that
100,
was what his
and
teacher
that was
was
a
telling him.
19, he had 99 clocked up, and he just was after that final one. It does give food for reflection, doesn't it? In terms of, if we trace back so many situations where one could have said something better, been a bit kinder, where one shouldn't have done something or should have done something. Personal reflection. Many, many years ago, when our children were still quite young, my mother bought a present, bought a gift. She bought four tickets to a show, a musical, Cats musical. And I was in my very, I was going to say fanatical, but very, very keen on practice and doing the right thing and watching the right things. And I was had very mixed feelings about this show. And to my shame, real shame, about a third of the way through, I said, I can't take any more of this. And I took the whole family out of the show. And I make this public confession to show how extreme one can be if one gets stuck in an idea about oneself. I've apologized since. But it just goes to show how one can get an idea and become very fanatical and obsessed about it, to the detriment of one's fellow human beings.
Was it the nails of the cats that
No, it's just the whole
disturbed
principle of, there is an injunction to avoid entertainment for the monastic tradition. So I think I probably translated that too far too much into my own agenda. So I've become much more tolerant. It's the sort of thing that sort of thing that sort of can come up, and one can sort of feel the body contract a little bit. Oh, did I really? Should I really have said that? So to acknowledge it and sort of process it, and in this case, I was able to make my apologies, which were accepted. I'm glad to say. I don't think I traumatized my children by depriving them of the show. But it is a lesson, certainly was a lesson for me, how being idealistic and can be such a dangerous double-edged sword. It can be done with the best of intentions. But it's particularly a problem, of course, if one's partner or is not in line with one's particular interest. This is a very extreme example of intolerance. But at the same time, what it does highlight is the conflict one can experience when trying to follow a tradition which says that encourages one to sit on a regular basis, not eat meat. There's another one. I stopped eating meat and I sort of basically made the family vegetarian. Yeah. Was that a good thing? Well, I cut myself a bit of slack on that one. But the principle is the same. How does one negotiate with one's partner about how one is spending one time? The many family holidays that I missed because of going on retreat instead of going on a holiday. So there's definitely collateral damage, even though the intentions behind what I was doing were really quite good. But the effect, you know, wasn't very nice. I wasn't there for the children in the way that I should have been, perhaps, as a parent. So it's a lesson, really, that one, I certainly wouldn't encourage anybody to do that. It reminds me of a very interesting story that Achan Browns in Australia gave of one of his students, lay students at the monastery that he was the abbot of, was very, very keen to go on a retreat. But he was much wiser and much more sensitive than I was, because what he did, he actually consulted his wife, and he said, you know, I'd really like to go on this 10-day retreat. And his wife said, well, look, there's so many things. The garage needs fixing. There's a roof leak there. I said, you can't really just go off for 10 days and leave these things undone. So he deferred and didn't go. And I think this happened two or three times, if I remember Achan Brown's account of it. And finally, she said, look, okay, you're pretty persistent. Obviously, it means a lot to you. Off you go, you know, go and spend your 10 days on the retreat. I'm not interested, but you go. So he went and came back. And the story goes that the next time he asked, he said, yes, please do go. The benefits of the retreat, he came back so friendly and open that his wife changed her mind and actually wished him to go. So...
Nice,
free of him. Yes, exactly. So one has to negotiate these things, and it's a question, of course, you know, the consequences can be quite bad in some cases. But what his example shows is that being respectful and acknowledging a commitment that he'd made in the first place, because he made the commitment to his wife to marry her and be a father with her, with the children, was something he had to factor in his decision to go on a retreat. Fortunately, the outcome was a good one. But of course, many relationships do break down. I've known two relationships where people have sort of stopped being with their partner because they didn't have the same compatible interest, even though it was a good interest to have, in my opinion. So it's, you know, food for reflection. And there's this wonderful formula, which I can come back to this afternoon if people are interested, while I say it now. There are five filters about right speech, which I use a lot in my work with people, and try and apply myself. That when speaking or addressing an issue with somebody, yes, there are several criteria that one needs to go through. And this is straight from the Buddhist texts, yes. One is it true what's being said? So important. You know, is it true not only as an objective truth, but is it true to me? So like an internal reflection. Is it true? Is it helpful to say what I want to say? And I like to translate that for actions. On, is it helpful for me to do X, Y, Z? So that's the next filter or test to go through. Third one is it the right moment to say what needs to be said or do what needs to be done? Well, these are completely logical, rational, you know, informative assessments to make. Fourth, is it said kindly? Does it come from a nice place? Because one can say the truth, yes. One can say it even at the right moment, perhaps. But if it's not said in a kind way, it can be quite counterproductive. And the fifth one is it communicated skillfully? So those are five criteria which one can sort of write down on a bit of paper, and every time one comes to an indecision or a position where one has to say something or do something significant, is to pull that little card out to oneself mentally and say, is it true? Is it helpful? Is it the right moment? Am I able to say it kindly? And can I communicate it skillfully so that it's understood by the recipient? Really, it's an amazing formula. It's comprehensive. It takes care of the other person, it takes care of oneself, and hopefully leads to an outcome. But it does mean that sometimes one finds oneself in a situation where one simply cannot say what needs to be said, even though it's very important. I came across a family recently here at the monastery, actually, where there was a dilemma about an illness that a cousin in the member of the family was going through. And her parents were not dealing with it in a way that the people I was talking to felt they should. And there was a tremendous amount of distress, a lot of tears, because this girl was really self-harming herself by what she was doing. And they just simply weren't getting any access. And they were torn because they wanted to say what that family should be doing, the one where the troubled child was. But they couldn't because there was no receptivity whatsoever. So in terms of those five filters, I think, yes, it's true. One does want to make a suggestion that is a helpful and a good one. Is it the right moment? Is it helpful? Yes. So it's true. It's helpful. Is it the right moment? No, it's not. Just by pushing on that point, you immediately clink, one of the numbers comes down. So there's no doubt there are plenty of situations in life when one comes across a sort of impasse of some kind. It's a stop where one just can't go further as much as one would want to. And sometimes one just has to suffer. And the suffering can be resolved by one's meditative practice. Because if I spoke earlier about the Brahma Viharas, these enlightened responses to situations, which is loving kindness, sympathetic or empathetic joy, compassion, and equanimity. Equanimity is where the wisdom comes in, which actually allows one to make that decision and sit often with something very, very uncomfortable that cannot be resolved by an intervention. So that's something that needs to take into account as well. Sometimes an intervention is not the right thing to do, even though it's the right thing to do. So there's a different type of value to it. Does that make sense? Yeah. So that's really gives a lot of, you know, that, where can one sort this out? One can consult with a friend, consult with a family member. But the ultimate consultation has to take place right here. You know, it happens in our hearts. What is my motive? Sometimes one can do the right thing for the wrong motive. One needs to assess the motive. Well, I'm only doing the right thing, but actually one could be working out one's own agenda. So being transparently true to oneself is an absolutely integral part of personal practice and development. And it's very, very challenging because life is messy. Not as we'd like it to be, which is dukkha. It's wanting things to be different. It's quite realistic to want things to be better, but at the same time, it needs to be tempered by wisdom. And wisdom comes with insight, and insight comes with an inquiry into what is what is happening. And that's an inquiry that I assume brings us here. It's that same thing. Life is not perfect. It is full of challenges. But this practice, which is based on principles of virtue, on ethical behavior, is a sound one because it gives one a framework, a platform to work from. And if that platform externally starts becoming internalized or lives by these values, one is on the path to becoming a better human being and ultimately a realized human being. But there's a lot of stuff to work through. Being born is a messy business. Being alive is a messy business. And getting out of it all takes a lot of disentanglement. And of course, this makes monasteries such as this so precious because the values that this monastery represents offers a path, a way out of it, because it reflects the Buddha's teachings. And it's one which is focused on the Buddha's teachings and how they apply in every life, which is what allows the community that we have here of monastics to be such an inspiration, because those are people just like you and I who take a decision to relinquish the things of so-called the world, yes? In other words, watch their attachment to things that are transient and often very meaningless and live a life with a sense of purpose, a sense of direction. Not everybody's designed for it. Not everybody has the circumstances or the conditions to become a monk or a nun. But certainly the principles that they embody can be reflected and found in our own hearts, in ourselves. And that's why they create a field of merit. It's interesting, from the Christian tradition, it was noted that life around monasteries where people lived a proper ethical life, weren't into drinking alcohol and fornicating and what have you, had a good field of energy around it. A lot of good things were happening around monasteries because the basic lifestyle was an ethical one. Well, we have to create little areas around ourselves which are ethically based. So if one can have a family life, a home or a flat or an apartment or what have you, which has these qualities embodied and lived, it changes the atmosphere in the flat or the house. One can walk in. I remember many years ago, when looking for a career, I worked as a door-to-door salesman for a short period. I never sold anything, by the way. But what I did do is go into a lot of homes, and you could walk into a house, and you can just sense, you know, what's going on inside. What are the vibes in this house? That's what it was called. Yeah, we can sense the vibes. We sense it from individuals as well. You meet some individuals, and you respond, "Oh gosh, it's a nice feeling. It brings a smile to the face." Sometimes one meets individuals or goes into a place which feels really oppressive and really heavy. So these are all aspects of the sensitivity that we potentially possess and which is amplified and balanced out, because one can be oversensitive and very, very precious by wisdom, by practice, by grounding. So when we sit on the cushions, yes, and we sit on a cushion and spend a long time beside, what we notice sitting in that silence is all the stuff that keeps on coming to the surface. Ajahn Chah had a very nice analogy. It's like being in a room, sitting in a chair, and people coming into this room. These are all the manifestations of thoughts, feelings, fantasies, dreams, expectations coming into the room. He says, just observe them. They come in, they go out. Don't engage in them. If you start engaging in them, you're potentially in trouble. You're getting involved and entangled in a conversation of some kind. Now, of course, again, as a metaphor, it only goes so far, because sometimes one does have to engage. One has no choice but to engage with a phenomenon that comes into one's field of awareness. But in terms of sitting practice, it's good to have a big chunk of one's practice just to observe and witness and not get engaged in the phenomena that arises. Notice how we do. The moment you notice that you're gone on a journey somewhere, is to stop, pause, come back into the present moment. Breathe in, breathe out, come back to the body. The body's senses are always here and now, which is why it's so, so good to know that you have a body and use that as a reference point to come back to and not get entangled in, should I be thinking about this? Shouldn't I be thinking about this? This is the right thing to do. That's all just mental proliferation. So one needs room for both, but the grounding of it all is just physical presence, being witnessing, irrespective of what comes into one's field of reference. In some other place, if my memory serves me well, Ajahn Chah also speaks of like being by a pool of water and just being there as a witness and just observing all the animals that come to feed from the water, but not get involved in them, not get engaged in them. So it's creating a witnessing role. This witnessing role is just another way of talking, just being aware. In the Zen tradition, they speak about the mirror mind. You know, that the mind, our awareness, yes, is just like a mirror. All it does is reflects what comes in. And if this appears, that's what appears. When it goes, it goes. But it makes no comment, doesn't put any pressure. It's just simply just a witnessing. We can go into this witnessing position. We're literally now in a witnessing position, unless you're asleep. If you're not asleep, then you're potentially in a witnessing position. What are you witnessing? Witnessing the body, the weight of the body, the cushion or the chair, position whether it's upright or not, whether something hurts or doesn't, the thoughts, ideas that might be coming to the surface, thinking about lunch. I mean, all sorts of things can be happening. But all of this is just you knowing. And I say you, yes, that there is just a knowing. That knowing doesn't belong to anybody. It's manifesting in this physical form that we're in. And that mathematical, that form is manifesting in this field of awareness, which is always present. And it's all-inclusive, doesn't exclude anything. But within it, we, as a conditioned being, have to take decisions about how we act on what arises in our consciousness. And that's where we take responsibility for the contents and the consequences of those. And that's what our practice comes down to, leading a good life. avoiding evil, doing good. And this is called what we're talking about, purifying the mind. Noticing negative, unwholesome states of mind, not encouraging them. Stepping out of them, not getting caught up in them. Even though the temptation might be good or big, I mean, not going into it. And then cultivating positive. So sometimes doing the opposite to what one would like to do is the right thing to do. At which point one challenges one's assumption. I don't want to be particularly generous. Be generous. I'm going to keep this for myself. No, give it away. You don't need it. So go against the grain of habit, grain of attachment, grain of craving, of holding on to things. See if you can, if not do exactly the opposite, just pause and not act. A phrase or a comment may come up, a criticism may come up in the mind about what someone is doing or saying. Just experiment. Don't say anything. As long as it's not, no one's being harmed or there's no damage, just experiment with that feeling of, gosh, that person really shouldn't be doing that. Just keep it to yourself. Suffer it, process it. And if you stay with it long enough, you'll find that in most cases, unless there is a justifiable reason, it'll fade, it'll lose its intensity. It's a bit like going for the ice cream in the fridge or something. You have this desire to satisfy the sense of taste. It's so tempting, so close, and you decide not to do it. Observe what the mind does with it. It'll come back sort of knocking on the door. Come on, come on. So good, so good. Just a little spoon, nobody will notice. Just wait long enough, could be a few minutes, and the craving will die. It'll then, the moment you notice that you check into it, you suddenly get a little message, gone, change your mind, and you don't have hope. Just experiment, notice what it feels like. That's how we work with craving, with desire to change things, because we're always trying to improve our conditions to feel better. But we're talking about a feeling better, which is not based on craving, which is not based on like and dislike, but is based on insight and being true to the moment, fully true to the moment. That's the well-being that we're looking for. And that's what our practice is about. So for lay life, I'll just say a little bit more because it's really important. You know, we face special challenges. Living in a community that is so supportive of practice is challenging, there's no doubt about it. I've spoken to enough monastics over the years and enough people who live in the monastery, how challenging it can be. But at least there's a common set of values here, sort of an unspoken agreement as to why people are here, for better, for worse, with all the problems that they might have. But being a lay person and living in a family and in the world where one is exposed to so many different values, especially as our society is fragmenting into all these isolated little beings with screens. It's very, very challenging. And it's all the more important to find some sort of reference points that one can refer back to, such as a practice like this or a tradition such as Buddhism, which at least gives some orientation, it gives some signposts. And if it's embodied by the people who are living in that tradition, such as lay people, all the better, because it's communicated on a personal level as an example. But it can be very, very heavy work if one is in a job which isn't particularly ethically orientated or with people who aren't ethically minded. It can be very challenging. All sorts of situations where one has to take a decision one way or another, whether one does the job, stays in the job, how one does it. Another confession coming up. For many years, I worked as a carpenter on building sites, and we were working on the tabernacle. Some of you may know it. It's a large building in Notting Hill Gate. It used to be a temple of some kind, a religious institute, lovely building. It was converted into a community hall, and I was one of the carpenters in the cooperative that was doing it up. And one day, a young guy came with a van load of tools, which had been stolen. And he was selling them at sort of a fraction of the cost. And I confess that I took advantage of one of those, and it was such a stone of burden that I took on. I had no idea that I'd pay such a price because I was so unhappy. That tool never sat comfortably in my toolkit. I did some. I handled stolen goods and enabled more theft to take place, obviously, because if you take something which isn't given, you're encouraging people who benefit from that to do more of it. So I, fortunately, I confess and have tried to put it right by being generous in many other ways, did something which wasn't right. But it wasn't right because someone told me so. Maybe my upbringing, my parents, the background gave me a set of values, but it just didn't sit right. And I had that tool for many years. I didn't want to throw it away. At the same time, it was tainted. It was like a poison tool in my toolkit. It was awful because shouldn't have been in my possession. It was illegitimately in my possession. But of course, that's again, pretty extreme example. There's a saying, I shall not do what the wise would later disapprove. Yeah, exactly. And that
is in Kalyanamitta
Sutta. Kalyanamitta Sutta. Yeah. That's right. That's right. The loving kindness sutta. It's a message. Fortunately, I had good parents, and I had generally a good moral background, but I never felt comfortable with this tool. I'd never show this tool off. It was a very nice Bosch drill. So technically, it had no, it was just a lump of metal with wiring in it, which did a job. But it had significance to me because I'd done something wrong, and I knew, and I felt guilty about it. And that's healthy, as long as I don't punish myself to the end of my life doing it. I learned a very profound lesson there, which allowed me then. There was a precursor. I once stole a sweet in a sweet shop when I was probably, I think it was like 8, 9 years old. Just the excitement of it and the fear of doing something that I shouldn't have done. So that one I can forgive very, very easily because I was young, experiment. Second one, you really made a bad, bad error there. It wasn't a good one. But what it did, it made me very clear, because in subsequent events, I was then running a workshop for several years, you'd get these odd people come in and say, come on, mate, all you've got, 5 for this, 10 for that. No, thank you. I was able to say it quite clearly, no thanks. Why? Because I'd been there. I know what it's like to take something that's not given, and I learned the lesson the hard way. So we chant the precepts. How does that apply to one's individual life in terms of truthful communication, yes, musavada. How do I deal? How do I use my sexuality? Do I exploit? Do I just objectify? Just get my own pleasure at the expense of someone else? Or is it within the context of a meaningful relationship? What does it mean to the other person? Otherwise, be aware of the other person as a human being, not just a body. Our society has gone mad on that front in terms of just objectifying external forms as being valuable and important. What really is important is the internal forms. It's the internal qualities that we possess and how we function. Taking life, how respectful are we of life? So those principles are there for a reason, because how can one meditate if I hadn't processed and sort of come to terms and understood what I'd done wrong with the drill? Yes, I wouldn't be able to sit in meditation. I came to meditation after that, because I was quite young when I stole that drill or took that drill from bought the drill. I then heard, actually, interestingly enough, just to complete the story, that the young man who was selling all these tools off cheap was actually taking them from his father's shop, and the shop went bankrupt. But of course it went bankrupt because he was selling stuff on the cheap. So another consequence. Which I contributed to in a way, probably. So how can one sit comfortably with knowing that one has made that omission, made that error, made that misjudgment? Well, first of all, by accepting responsibility, I can clear the debt, as it were, and just be generous in other ways in my life, and not repeat the mistake. But often we have to make a mistake to learn from it. That's something, another thing I've learned in life. So we can go back into our life and think of the situations where we got things wrong. Question is, did I learn? Did you learn anything from that experience that is for your good or for the benefit of others? Because we live, and up till now have lived in a universe, on a planet that has allowed for errors. We're getting to the stage now that the collective amount of errors that we're making as a human race is going to destroy the planet. That's the way it's going. But we've had this wonderful window of opportunity, and we have it in our lives now, to learn from what we're doing. Have I learned anything? Am I going to be a better person? Am I going to avoid doing what I did, which I know is wrong? That's an important process to go through. Having processed it, and if one can then sit peacefully on a cushion without one's sense of conscience and responsibility coming up and poisoning the sitting. You know, one can't really get into a pure state of being if one is quote unquote impure, still sullied by greed, attachment, and anger. So, as Ajahn Chah said, everything is teaching us. Everything is teaching us. Literally, even this carpet is teaching us something. It's impermanent. That's what it's teaching us. But every situation we have, every situation we find ourselves in, is teaching us something. So are we learning from it, or are we just repeating patterns of behavior? That's the question we need to ask ourselves. So finding like-minded people who are on the same wavelength in terms of a principled approach to life, you're in good company. And what did the Buddha say about the Sangha, or good company? Yes, it's the whole of the spiritual life. Yeah, so it's a lesson for us. So having spiritual friends is a blessing. Treat them well, be kind to them, and say thank you, because you're very fortunate if you have a good spiritual friend.